issues to do with war and peace in this country.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!, coming to you from Tucson, Arizona.
As an indigenous person of Turtle Island, we don't believe in borders. We don't believe in the division of land, the ownership of land. And so we're here to protest the border.
Today we go south of the border, where hundreds march from Nogales, Arizona to Nogales, Mexico. More than 150 immigrants have died as they attempted to cross the border into the United States. We'll talk with cross-border organizers about maquiladoras and about the dangers on the border. Then, as conservative foundations are in their heyday, supporting groups like the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation, we go to a progressive philanthropist convention here in Tucson.
There are grant makers involved in redistributing wealth in support of the redistribution of power.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Bolivia, at least 35 people died during protests over the last 2 days, bringing the total number of protesters dead to at least 45 over the past month. In response to the mass union-led demonstrations, Bolivian President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada suspended the controversial plan to export gas via Chile to the United States, but he refused to step down from office. Protesters also called for land reform, better wages, and improved pension plans. Four members of the president's cabinet resigned in protest, and the Bolivian vice president, Carlos Mesa, withdrew support for the president, saying, quote, "As a citizen or man of principle, I cannot back this government if its response to mass pressure is death." In Israel, a senior United Nations official is estimating up to 1,500 Palestinians have been left homeless following an Israeli raid into the Gaza. The raids were codenamed Operation Root Canal. Up to 120 homes were demolished. One UN official told the BBC Gaza looked like it had been hit by a severe earthquake. And today, the Israeli military ordered 15 Palestinian detainees in the West Bank to be expelled to the Gaza Strip. None of the detainees have been charged with a crime or tried in court. The BBC reports the mass expulsion is unprecedented in scope. Human rights groups have condemned previous expulsions. Palestinian Cabinet Minister Saeb Erekat said of the move, quote, "It's a very dangerous step. This is not an act of self-defense. This is an act that deserves the condemnation." The Los Angeles Times is reporting Israel now has the ability to fire nuclear missiles from submarines. This gives the Israeli military the ability to launch atomic weapons from land, air, and beneath sea. Egypt's ambassador to the United States said Israel's clandestine nuclear program could lead to a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. In related news, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency is upping pressure on Iran. Mohammed El-Baradei plans to visit there on Thursday. In a final attempt to win a UN Security Council resolution, the Bush administration announced on Monday that the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council would set a timetable by December 15th for writing a constitution and holding elections. The U.S. is seeking a new U.N. resolution with hopes that it would encourage more countries to provide troops and financial assistance to Iraq. A vote on the new resolution could come as soon as Wednesday. In Iraq, a twin suicide bombing outside the Baghdad hotel killed at least 8 Iraqis on Sunday. The hotel houses many members of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council, as well as U.S. contractors. Agence France-Presse is also reporting that hours later, Iraqi oil minister Ibrahim Bar al-Alum and an aide to the Governing Council member Ahmad Chalabi escaped an assassination attempt in Baghdad. On Monday, the governor of the province of Diyala survived an assassination attempt as he was traveling to work. Also, 3 U.S. soldiers were killed north of Baghdad. The U.S. military is coming under criticism after it was revealed that newspapers around the country received form letters from soldiers stationed in Iraq that apparently appeared to be personally written. The 5-paragraph letter outlined recent successes in Iraq, including the reestablishment of police and fire departments. Part of the letter read, quote, "Children smile and run up to shake hands and in their broken English shouting, 'Thank you, mister.'" At least one soldier from West Virginia told his father he never even saw the letter that appeared under his name in the local newspaper. The father told reporters, quote, "When I told him he wrote such a good letter, he said, 'What letter? This is just not his writing style.'" All of the letters came from soldiers in the 2nd Battalion of the Army's 503rd Airborne Infantry Regiment. A spokesperson for the regiment defended the use of the letters, saying, quote, "With the current and ongoing media focus on casualties and terrorist attacks, we thought it equally important to share with the American public the good news associated with our work." At least 11 newspapers, including the Boston Globe, ran the letter, not knowing it was a form letter. USA Today is reporting that 14 members of the military have committed suicide in Iraq, forcing the Pentagon to study whether the long deployments there are causing a high rate of suicide. The Army is also investigating whether a dozen more soldier deaths were actually suicides. In addition, the Army has sent nearly 500 soldiers home from Iraq because they are suffering from various mental health ailments. On Monday, Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich officially announced he's running for president in 2004. He said his first act as president would be to withdraw the U.S. from NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the World Trade Organization. He also called for the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, universal health care, universal preschool daycare, and free tuition at public colleges and universities. He told supporters, quote, "I'm running for president of the United States to challenge this system, which traps so many of America's children and adults in fear, violence, and poverty, and makes us pay for wars we don't want and causes us to sacrifice our children's future." Saudi Arabia has announced it will hold its first elections since 1932. The state news agency announced Saudis will be given a chance to elect some of the members of the Council of Ministers. The move is seen as one of the kingdom's first real political reforms. The announcement came during the country's first ever human rights conference, which was taking place in Riyadh. In addition, Saudi officials announced on Tuesday it had handed over the United States at least 3 U.S. citizens suspected of ties to terrorist groups. President Bush announced Friday new efforts to track down and punish U.S. citizens who illegally travel to Cuba, even if they travel through a country that maintains ties to Cuba. During a White House meeting with opponents of Cuban President Fidel Castro, Bush also announced the formation of a committee to plan for Cuba's post-Castro future. In environmental laws, the U.S. Navy has agreed to drastically reduce its use of a low-frequency sonar system. Environmentalists have argued the sonar system disorients and kills endangered whales. That's some of today's news coming to you from Tucson, Arizona. Over the last year, at least 151 immigrants have died crossing the border into the United States. Many of them have died of dehydration. Some put the figure at over 200. It's just that 151 bodies have been found. This weekend, the Democracy Now! Team traveled to Tucson, Arizona. On this Columbus Day weekend, what many call Anti-Discoverers Day, what others observe as Indigenous Peoples Day throughout the United States. This weekend, we went to the U.S.-Mexican border and covered a protest from Nogales, Arizona, to Nogales, Mexico, in the state of Sonora. Come with us as we go south of the border. Protesters have just crossed the border from Nogales, Arizona, to Nogales, Sonora, in Mexico. And they are protesting, yes, the border. The last banner that came across said how many people must die. The number so far this year, this area of Arizona crossing into the United States, 151.
My name is Ixpapalot. I'm here because as an indigenous person of Turtle Island, we don't believe in borders. We don't believe in the division of land, the ownership of land. And so we're here to protest the border. And because of the implementation of the border, the division of the land that has existed for over 500 years, thousands of people die every year crossing this false border that's been invented by man. So we're here to protest it, to burn the border down, because as indigenous people, as humans of this earth, we do not recognize this border.
My name is Isabel Garcia from Derechos Humanos. We've crossed here, as we do every year, to join with our brothers and sisters in Mexico to show this community that we have no borders as a community, and that as our countries become gatekeepers, we'll be gatebusters. We marched to the border from the U.S., and our Mexican counterparts marched to the border north. We marched south, they marched north, and we met in unity. And it's the most amazing border probably in this world, where poverty clashes with this superpower that utilizes and grinds down Mexican workers and then causes their deaths.
Estoy aquí para mostrar mi inconformidad.
I'm here to demonstrate my resistance to the egotism imposed by the United States. Those of us who live here on the border, we see the massive brutality of the Border Patrol, and no one is recognizing it. It doesn't interest them.
Why are you wearing a wool mask over your face, hiding your face?
Porque por mi visa, tengo mica.
I'm wearing this face mask because I can be identified by my visa, and the Border Patrol will create problems for me. They can take pictures and shoot video. I prefer not to reveal my face. I recognize the egotism and racism that exists in that country, even though I cross over quite frequently.
Do you know anyone who's been hurt or killed or died crossing into the United States?
Sí, varias personas. Otra vez, yo como...
I've seen many people hurt. And being someone who lives by the border, I see the abuses here daily. People getting beaten, dying. There is a contraband of people's bodies, and more than anything, racism.
Contrabando de cuerpos, y más que nada racismo.
Can you tell us the story of one person who was hurt?
Era una vez un joven.
There was a 16-year-old man who didn't have food, money, or shelter.
No tenía comida. No tenía hogar. Y buscó el
and he searched for the American dream.
Y lo que sucedió,
and what happened was that the American dream was taken away by the sun and by racism.
Por el sol y el racismo. Aparte del sol,
suffering in the sun, he didn't have water or help from anyone. They left him to lay like an animal, as if he was worthless.
Dejaron ir como un animal, como algo sin importancia, por varias personas que.
I found out about this story through many people seeking the same dream, but this particular story was told to me by someone who had traveled with him. This is part of a history of many people who have crossed.
Y muchas de las cuales han pasado.
My name is Eric.
And how old are you?
20 years.
And do you live here in Nogales?
Yes.
Why are you here?
We've been participating in demonstrations for 5 years. I came to the Nogales border in 1998. My family are migrants from the south of Mexico. We began to participate and deal with the problems here of immigration, the economy, and the issues of migrating from the southern part of the country to here. We began participating in the movement here because we are migrants and we recognize the problems that existed here on the border.
Empezamos a ver la problemática que hay con la gente al vivir aquí en Nogales, en la frontera.
Do you know people have tried to go into the United States and were not able to, or got hurt, or got killed?
Sí, de hecho, tengo un amigo.
I have a friend who died on the border from dehydration. He came from a poor family from the southern part. His name was José Velázquez.
José Velázquez.
He was 15 years old.
15 years old. And what exactly happened?
Él intentó cruzar, creo que por. El lado de este lado de la frontera.
He tried to cross from this side of the border through the mountains.
Pero por las montañas de este lado de Nogales, se perdió y no tenía agua.
And he got lost. And he had no more water, and they found him dead.
Who found him?
Immigration officials.
Where is he buried?
De hecho, él lo
his body was returned to Guadalajara because his family reclaimed him.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Tucson, Arizona. That piece this weekend as we went over the border from Nogales, Arizona to Nogales, Mexico in the state of Sonora. We're joined right now by one of those people who was on this march, the cross-border mobilization, Isabel Garcia. Mm-hmm. She's an attorney and activist with the Coalition for Human Rights. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
We're also with Teresa Leal, who is an organizer with the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice, who took people this weekend on a tour of the maquiladoras on the border in Mexico. Welcome.
No, thank you.
Well, let's continue this discussion of what is happening to immigrants who are attempting to go over the border into the United States. The number, I think, most people in this country are not aware, and this is just this area of Arizona. How many again?
According to an investigator from the Arizona Republic, there had been 205 deaths as of September 30 of 2003. One fiscal year for the Border Patrol, simply between the border of Arizona and Sonora, Mexico, in 1 year.
How are people dying?
People are dying because they're being routed and funneled through the deserts, the harsh terrain. Most of them are dying because of heat-related reasons. Some people have been killed in accidents where they roll over, where they're being chased by the Border Patrol. But by and large, the dehydration issue, as a direct result of the funneling caused by the Border Patrol strategy of sealing up the major points of entry where people traditionally crossed.
We watched or looked at this border between Arizona and Mexico, a metal corrugated wall that is made from the landing strips that were used during the Persian Gulf.
The landing mats, that's correct, that were used on the ships, of course, during the Gulf War. That's exactly. They're metal. Yeah, it feels like we're at war with Mexico if you stand next to that wall.
When did this wall go up?
This wall between Arizona and Sonora started in about 1996, just as our politicians were telling us that NAFTA would be the answer to all of the migration issues is when they started putting up the wall. We knew full well that, in fact, NAFTA would exacerbate the situation, which it has, and they have, you know, continued to build the walls all along the border. But here in Arizona, they had plans to build another 255 miles of steel metal wall at a cost of at least $1 million per mile, just in terms of the construction, not the labor.
What about the militarization of the border, and have things changed since September 11th?
Absolutely. I think people need to understand that the militarization of the border was in full gear before 9/11. Their intentions, of course, began in the mid-1990s with Operation Hold the Line, Operation Gatekeeper out of San Diego, Operation Rio Grande in the Valley of Texas, and, of course, Operation Safeguard, if you can believe that's the name, Operation Safeguard here in Arizona. And that is a very strategic plan on the part of the Border Patrol to systematically close one area at a time and funnel people into particular areas, wait until the funneling is successful. In other words, right now there's 1,500 people that arrive in Altar, Sonora, just south of the border, every single day in busloads. They line up and board shuttles to cross into the United States. Their intentions then are to continue the funnel, cause division and chaos within those communities, have deaths, and eventually have the local communities throw up their arms and say, okay, militarize this border too, you know, give us more agents, we'll seal it up, and then it moves on. We believe that the next point, of course, of death will be in Texas.
Isabel Garcia, attorney and activist of the Coalition for Human Rights, will be back with her, as well as an organizer with the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice, in a minute, as we turn now to a Tucson-based folk singer who has been performing in this area and around. This is Kathleen Williamson.
For 20 years we shared our home and bed. Under heaven's eyes we were wed. She never learned her own sweet mother's tongue, for they came to this land when she was young. Kingdoms rise and are inclined to their own brand of law and order. Like menacing landmines, the sentencing guidelines sent my love across the border, sent my love south of the border. Now the stars seem more near than where you are, my dear. We won't let politics decide. In the thunder of my dreams, I turn asunder all the schemes when we meet beyond the great divide. Like a moth in flight, I follow the bright light. Day and night your candle burns. While a nocturne plays, the swallow flies away. What good is freedom when there's no return? What good is freedom when there's no return? What good is freedom when there's no return? Ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Ba-ba-da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Kathleen Williamson here at Access Tucson, the public access TV station in Tucson that we are broadcasting from. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue our discussion of the border. We are joined by Isabel Garcia, who is an attorney and activist with the Coalition for Human Rights, and also Teresa Leal, an organizer with the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice. As immigrants attempt to come over the border, estimates are just in this year alone here in Arizona, more than 200 have died. You are also working on the south of the border, on the maquiladora issue. Can you talk about the situation for workers there, Teresa?
Well, the situation for workers in the maquilas has been an experience that for more than 30 years has been like the laboratory where the globalization process has been tried, and different strategies are in place to see how all of the cheap labor market can be controlled under these large economic blocks. And that comes from the industrial or the big corporate agendas. But on the other side, which is the grassroots, the working class, and the need to survive, has produced also, a strategy that we have tried, that we have created. We have tried and tested many things other than unionization. We've also developed an industrial revolution a la Mexicana, which is also the industrial revolution that a lot of folks are sucked into, are not prepared for, but the accident then that we are just a part of this agenda, of this industrialization agenda, has forced us, coming from rural areas, indigenous areas, and very traditional ways of surviving, into immediate high tech without any preparation or negotiation. And that's why when NAFTA began to be fast-tracked, we immediately knew that we needed to resist this. We needed to surface all of the issues that we had been struggling with as the maquiladora came to be. And we call, the maquiladora just to make the world the maquiladora, for these corporations. And so in Nogales, it hasn't been any different. We were a lot less urban prepared than a lot of areas like, Ciudad Juarez and Tijuana. But I think that over these 30 years, for example, our network has created, the strategy, which is a networking strategy, to get little groups and little local experiences tied so that we could create the indicators of development strategy, so that we can follow the bad actors from place to place and share that information.
Can you talk about what workers face in terms of the toxins, for example, in the environment? You can talk about particular companies or factories.
All right. What workers face is, again, just coming out of the darkness, no preparation again. And we've had to learn, to discern, from, high-tech jargon, things that can cause cancer, that can cause tumors, respiratory diseases.
Like what?
The most endemic is lead. Over 70% of the maquilas have lead in some process. I'll just mention one. Prestolite makes, batteries, the terminals for car batteries and other, spark plugs. All of that is a high content of lead in it. Workers, and 2 years ago, we had to mobilize and shut down the plant just by, just blocking the entrance, because workers were getting 50 parts per million in their bloodstream of lead. And the only reason they found out is because they were getting dizzy spells. They were having chronic headaches. They had nervous problems. And they didn't go to the plant manager because he refused to accept that. They would test them, and the testing would be secret. They would not allow them to know the results. 10 parts per million is acceptable, and even that is not acceptable.
Does the EPA play any role here, the Environmental Protection Agency of the United States, on the Mexican side of the border?
Lately, yes, a little, because the exchange of information. There's a push to make universal standards available, but that's still heavily resisted. The EPA only establishes parameters that we can compare to, that as activists we can say, well, if this is not acceptable in the United States, this, 50 parts per million is incredible. And people would be given a diuretic and sent home to pee for 3 days. And to get that much lead out of people's bloodstream is incredible. Permanent damage is caused by that. But we do, for example, indirectly, we use the standards in order to challenge these corporations that come out of the United States, that have their headquarters in the United States or in other developed countries that should adhere to that. There are voluntary standards that they do, or programs like the ISOs, which are the international systems, but they're purely voluntary. So the way I'm speaking, you can tell right away that this isn't something that a worker on the line is really very well versed in. So we require to teach people, about this in simple ways, in ways that they can assimilate and take back into their plant and negotiate these changeovers.
Isabel Garcia, how are people organizing?
Well, here in Tucson, Arizona, southern Arizona, we've been fortunate that we've been organizing for 30 years. In these 30 years, we have created a coalition with labor, with environmental groups, and with the religious groups. In the 1970s, this didn't exist. We now have a large community here that is attempting to resist really the national phenomenon, though the anti-immigrant fervor of this country is at an all-time high. The ignorance about the contributions of immigrants is at an all-time high. We have a denial of what the reality is in this country, and that is that we depend on the immigrant labor force. But for the immigrant labor force, undocumented immigrant labor force in this country, our economy would be in shambles. In fact, certain sectors of the economy would fall apart in less than one day. The other thing that we're ignorant about is that we have created this particular phenomenon of attraction and repulsion, attracting labor force at times of economic boom and trying to deport people when we have systemic problems, so that the American public does not focus on why we're having economic downturn. Immigrants are always pulled out as the convenient scapegoat. I think in this country we just need massive education about the issues about immigration and the border.
Are maquiladoras leaving? Are these factories leaving, either going south deeper into Mexico and Central and South America, or other places entirely? And what does that mean for the people who are working in them? Teresa Leal.
Well, the maquiladoras are here to stay. The ones that are here, basically, I'd say that in the last 5 years, there has been a crisis in the maquiladoras, but that's due to the lowering of prices and the lack of successes in the market itself, in the buying of goods all over the world and as well as in the United States. So a lot of these markets, because they are having fewer customers, are folding. A lot of them are folding or downsizing. They're creating more robots to replace the line workers, but there's now with the FTAA, which plans to change the entire Latin American continent into a maquiladora. There's talk about it, you know, just spreading all over. And there that might be, but I don't think it will be as fast or as complete as it seems, because the fuel costs, you know, for transportation are still what keeps the maquiladoras on the U.S.-Mexico border, because costs of fuel were something that has been dealt with before, and that's the attraction that the U.S.-Mexico border has. So it will retain a large majority of these maquilas, but they are downsizing in many ways, and they are going into the interior of Mexico. Now, I don't know if you realize that there's also a lot of unrest, political unrest in Mexico, social unrest, and that tends to spook industrial development. Right now, very few of these maquiladoras can really develop a huge expansion projects. But one of them, just last week, was inaugurated by Presidente Fox and Boers, the Sonoran governor, and that is the Ford plant in Hermosillo. But it's expanding in order to produce more vehicles. But right now, the Ford plant produces 600 Ford Tracers, which are little compact cars, a day, which are shipped through Nogales and come into Tucson to be distributed all over the country. And yet they're now expanding, but the expansion is going to be with robots. And apparently that will produce more production and byproducts. But I don't think that maquilas will go away.
For people around the country, what do you think, Isabel Garcia, is the most important fact for us to understand about this border where you live?
That we are so far away from the seats of power, both Washington, D.C. and Mexico City, and yet we feel the impact, of course, of legislation coming from there, in particular the United States. The border policy, I think, is a criminal act. I think we will be judged harshly. Most people ignore the situation here at the border. The 205 bodies have been found. As you stated, there's many bodies that have not been found. Border Patrol continues to deny the deaths that their agency doesn't find. In other words, if the county sheriffs find a body, they refuse to do it. They've caused incredible division. As you know, we've got vigilantes acting out border policy here with impunity. We have people dying on a daily basis. And we have immigrants that continue to suffer all of the issues that the immigrants suffer in the interior without being given the benefit of what they've contributed to this country. Our dependence on the immigrant labor force is unbelievable, and more our country is is acting as a gatekeeper for the multinational corporations attempting to create really a maquiladora nation in Mexico and in the countries south of Mexico.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Isabel Garcia with the Coalition for Human Rights and Teresa Leal, organizer with the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back from our break, we're going to talk with some funders who have come to Tucson for a National Progressive Philanthropist Convention who fund organizations like the ones you have just heard from. And we'll talk about the success of progressive philanthropy as compared to conservative philanthropies in this country. And then we'll find out about a protest on top of Mount Graham, a protest against the University of Arizona putting telescopes on the sacred land. Stay with us as we go to another Tucson musician, Rachel Garland.
Walking into the factory, there's a clock to punch. Close quarters, identical conditions. The boss gets nervous when we talk to each other much. Corporate wage is fine if you're on the inside, far from assembly lines, white collar crime. Sun goes down on 10,000 pairs of shoes, each one soaking in profit, but the boss doesn't care to share the news. All the money goes back to his pocket, yeah. The corporate wage is fine if you're on the inside, far from assembly lines, white collar crime. Brand name products, they multiply just like the chain stores where we buy the rows and rows of things on every aisle. We recognize the excess we're trying to provide, but oh, we're running out of time.
Rachel Garland, another musician based here in Tucson, Arizona. Democracy Now! Broadcasting live from Access Tucson this weekend. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to an interesting conference that's taking place in Tucson, election season is rapidly approaching. Right-wing funding organizations are in their heyday. Over the past decades, they've built up such institutions as the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the American Enterprise Institute. At the same time, we're witnessing a Fox Newsization of the media in this country, with increasingly sensationalized coverage that's heavily skewed towards supporting the agenda for the right. Organizations like the Heritage Foundation putting out reports that the Fox News reports on, and the other media feels the pressure of Fox, and everyone tries to outfox each other. Well, conservative funding organizations have long understood the power of the media in directing public opinion, and the institutions they fund are the dominant forces that are commenting on radio and TV networks. A group of progressive philanthropists is trying to counter this move, and we are joined by two of them. Anthony Riddle is with the Funding Exchange, which is based in New York, and Kolu Zigbe is with the Jesse Smith Noyes Foundation. They're here this weekend in Tucson, Arizona, for a conference on progressive philanthropy called the National Network of Grantmakers, known as the NNG. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you both. Kolu Zigbe, let's begin with you. The Jesse Smith Noyes Foundation, what is it, and how can you start off by talking about the kind of current funding climate we are in and how successful the conservative foundations have been?
Okay. Thanks for having us here. The Jesse Smith Noyes Foundation is actually an environmental and reproductive rights foundation, but we understand that the kind of change that we're seeking to support has to be long-term. We believe that the Earth is one community that's made up of social and environmental systems, and that our mission is to protect the sustainability of those systems. That's a long-term proposition, and our view is that the way to do that is through social movements that can maintain the accountability of decision makers, corporate boards, into the long term. And so progressive philanthropy, I think that the commonality is not in the way that we do our grant making, but in the values behind it. So you'll find a whole, you know, range of different foundations. Jesse Smith Noyes happens to be a family foundation. We have operating foundations that are based on memberships, that do their fundraising, they get their money through different means. But the commonality is that we all use a social justice lens, where we're trying to
get redistribute wealth to the people that are suffering, that are affected by the imbalances in power, by the injustice, and to support their leadership in the movement for social change.
Do you feel pressure from the Bush administration in terms of what kind of grants you give? Has the landscape changed?
There's a lot of pressure because there's less public support for basic services. At the same time, the war on terror has affected people's lives, so that the kind of activism that we saw on the border is real risky business. People are being thrown in jail. The climate is such that social justice activists are doing a lot of firefighting, just protecting their ability to speak out and use their basic civil rights, free speech. So what's happening is that the same time that we're in this economy where we have, you know, our endowments are not growing at the rate that would support a lot of giving, the need on the street and in the communities is greater than ever, both in terms of basic services that should be supported by the public sector and in terms of protecting civil rights and human rights. So we're challenged to give more, and we have less now because of the economic downturn.
Tony Riddle, you're with Funding Exchange in New York. Can you explain what that is? And also, in this time when groups are really struggling, it seems that there's a kind of contradiction, which is those that are working the hardest, that need the most, hardly have time to stop to write grants or even know where to turn.
Well, I work with the Funding Exchange, which is an organization that was begun to bring together people of wealth and activists decades ago. There's, I think, 16 member funds. I'm fairly new there. And I'm with a new fund called the Media Justice Fund. And the purpose of the Media Justice Fund is to bring together in coalition people who work for social justice with people who are media advocates and have media know-how. We sort of recognized that there was a chasm between the two groups, that the one group has the army, you know, the grassroots activists that work directly with the community, and that there's been sort of a technological and legal group, intelligentsia, who has worked very hard to create media democracy. So we're trying to create opportunities for these groups to work together with the understanding that the social justice movement really needs to figure out how to incorporate this media piece into its core value and its mission.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you break things down? What are your criteria, and how do you reach out into the community to let people know that you're out there?
Well, I have the fortune of writing the new documents on this organization. So I'm actually going around the country right now to various communities to talk with community activists and media advocates and try and figure out what are the things that people need. Because, you know, you can't really have any kind of organization without some sort of communication. You see the way that our progressive movement is being disorganized by Rupert Murdoch and his minions with the constant disinformation that goes on out there. It makes it very hard to organize. So on the one level, you know, programs like yours and other programs need to be supported so that we have sort of the binding information that we need in our communities. But on another level, we also need to create capacity for activists to be able to speak to each other. So that, for instance, if you have people organizing across the American colonies, the American territories in the South Pacific, these are very great distances between people who have very much in common and need to organize. So that, for instance, if we were able to turn up a project which created a communication system between activists of like needs, this would be viewed as very important. We don't view ourselves as having enough money to go and create a new Fox network or anti-Fox network or whatever, but we do have the resources to target specific information and communication systems that'll help people organize. And then we hope after that that the people will also be able to organize to protect communication systems so that you have sort of a back-and-forth synergy.
Mm-hmm. Kola Zigbee, do you see the model that Conservative Foundations has used as one that progressive philanthropy should emulate?
Well, I think that clearly they've been successful. So we have some important lessons that we need to learn. And we try to take those lessons, but also recognize that what they've done has not been informed, obviously, by a social justice lens. They don't have the same values that we have.
So the lessons that we're learning are that this is long-term movement building. They started more than a decade ago coordinating their strategy. They support vertically. That means on the ground, grassroots organizing, media messaging, think tanks, capacity building. They do long-term grants, general operating support. Those are some of the things that, yes, I think that they need to inform the kind of grant making that we do. And so we are, and we've been, actually the Jesse Smith Noyce Foundation has been doing that. We give general operating grants because we believe that the groups that we fund know what's the best use for their money. So we're not doing project support. And too many foundations, mainstream and progressive, have been addicted to project support instead of general operating support.
How do people find out about your foundations and others?
Yeah.
For many, it is one of the best-kept secrets. And again, for those that need the most support, they're least likely to be able to tap into this world.
Well, most of our foundations have websites. So the Noyce Foundation is www.noyce.org.
That's N-O-Y-E-S.
And the National Network of Grantmakers is also an important source. That's NNG, www.nng.org. And they also have a common application form. And one of the important roles that it's played is simplifying the application process. So all the members of NNG accept the same application form. So you don't have to remake and tailor your application for, you know, everybody that you're seeking funding from. And that application form can be downloaded from their website.
Mm-hmm. And have the rules changed for philanthropies, Tony Riddle? Do you feel now in the Bush administration that there is a chill around the organizations that you can fund and your colleagues in the funding world here and also internationally?
Well, you know, I've heard that that exists. I'm fortunate enough to be in an organization that's very clear about what it's about. And in fact, I don't see why we shouldn't be able to capitalize on the existing atmosphere, because people know now more than ever that they need us. I think there's a real disconnect going on, even in the average person here, between what they hear on the news and radio and television and compared to what they're experiencing in their lives. And I think we need to move into that gap and help people to understand, you know, what the problem is. So I think we actually have a compelling opportunity as well. We don't take funds from the government generally anyway. You know, our base is solid.
But can they crack down on where you spend your money, where you give?
Well, I understand that there has to be some care taken in terms of, you know, the Patriot Act and how it looks at who you give your money to and whether they're going to, in retrospect, determine that that was related to some terrorist organization or something. So I know that those issues are out there. But I think we just proceed.
And the website for Funding Exchange?
It's fex.org. And I would like to mention that I'm holding some community meetings in Seattle early next week and Portland later in the week. And if you'd like to, if any community organizations in those areas would like to attend to talk about these issues, they should either call 911 Arts, Media Arts in Seattle, or McKenzie River Gathering in Portland as soon as possible, and we'll include you.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Anthony Riddle of the Funding Exchange and Kolu Zogby with the Jesse Smith Noyce Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! And watching it on public access TV stations around the country as well. We're broadcasting from Access Tucson in Tucson, Arizona. We're going to break for some musical images from the border, and then we'll find out about a protest that took place yesterday at the University of Arizona. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! Yesterday at the University of Arizona, students marked Indigenous Peoples Day in solidarity with the San Carlos Apache people by protesting plans of the university to build telescopes on Mount Graham, considered sacred by the Apache people. Opponents of the plan claim the telescope construction disrespects the traditions of the Apache and harms mountain lands. Mount Graham's old-growth forests have led to the evolution of 18 rare plant and animal species. Opponents to the telescope plan include several Native American tribes, United Nations, the National Council of Churches. We're joined right now by Rod Coronado, who was at the protest, a well-known Native American environmental activist who's participated in direct action with the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Describe what is going on.
Well, over the last 15 years, the U of A have been desecrating this holy place for not only the Apache tribe, but the Pascua-Yaqui tribe as well, and numerous tribes where, for hundreds if not thousands of years, we have been praying and worshiping, gathering medicinal herbs, and they've essentially cut out the heart of the mountain. They've destroyed 8 acres of the last known breeding habitat for the Mount Graham red squirrel, and also cut a 12-mile power line up to the mountain, and they're presently diverting water from our sacred springs to flush their toilets. So this is, you know, cultural genocide at its worst. They were even so blatant as to have the project be called the Columbus Project until PR firms advised them that it was worthwhile to change that name. But still, the partnership is with the Vatican, who this past spring shipped over in a ship from Italy the framework for the telescope, which is presently being erected on top of the mountain.
Hmm. Now, University of Arizona lawyers have argued that the telescopes, which are situated on public land, are exempt from U.S. cultural and environmental protection laws, including the American Indian Religious Freedom Act and the National Historic Preservation Act. Why?
Well, once again, because of those laws' effectiveness that they would have stalled this project, the U of A put in hundreds of thousands of dollars to their lobbyists that they maintain in D.C. to win these exemptions. As you said, not just from the Endangered Species Act that would protect the Mount Graham red squirrel, but also a National Environmental Policy Act. When they built the pipe, the power line, they...
But on what grounds are they exempt?
The grounds is basically on science. They've argued that this is... invaluable science that they have to accomplish, even though their own astronomy experts have said that the viewing time on Mount Graham is extremely limited and not ideal for their purposes.
Why is Mount Graham so important?
World intact. It's the gateway into other worlds. That we are told by our elders is the essential roadmap for our future to keep our traditions alive. And, in order to preserve our worldview, we need our sacred places. You know, they would never build such a monstrosity in their places of worship, so why should they do it on ours?
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We've been joined by Rod Coronado, who was protesting Columbus Day. I want to thank everyone here at Access Tucson who has been a part of this production. We'll be naming names tomorrow to thank everyone when we come back to New York, and thank the amazing crew of Democracy Now! Who traveled here and worked so hard. DemocracyNow.org is our website. 1-800-881-2359 is the number to get a copy of today's show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.